Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do memory, experience, and hard-learned lessons contribute to a chef's approach to creativity and service? These days, Gabrielle Hamilton and her tiny New York restaurant Prune are the darling of food critics, fellow chefs, and diners alike. They are charmed by the pretense-free atmosphere and the unabashed embrace of what tastes good rather than what is trendy in fine dining. But although Hamilton was raised to love and appreciate good food, she never had a day of formal culinary education, choosing instead to get a master's degree in fiction writing and learning about cooking in part in a long series of less than distinguished jobs in the food service industry. She writes candidly about her personal and professional life in her new memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. Gabrielle, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Your parents each played different roles in the way you grew up thinking about food and about what it meant to feed others. Can you tell us first about your mom, who I guess was the one cooking all the time when you were little?
Yeah, she had to pull it together on my artist father's paycheck. So she was feeding our family of seven on a kind of mercurial, sporadic income. She was she's French. She had French parents, and they were wartime parents. So she learned, I think, from them quite a sense of thrift and how to get everything comestible from an animal and how to cut the moldy parts away from anything and still eat what was remaining. So from her, I really learned that kind of discipline and thrift. And also, we ate very, very well because of her. We ate pretty delicious food that was not the normal American fare at the time.
You were eating marrow and things like that.
Well, yeah, we ate a lot of low cuts. I think what's kind of trendy now called nose-to-tail eating, and we grew up eating things that we did not enjoy at the time, I must say. It felt rather masochistic to be at that dinner table when you're an 8-year-old. But, yeah, we ate calves' brains in brown butter with capers. We ate, shanks and necks. Things with marrow-filled bones in them, for sure.
And you were not carrying, like, Twinkies and bologna sandwiches to school?
No, I was jealous. We had that oily brown paper lunch bag that reeked of something non-traditional in it. And, I wanted the Partridge Family lunchbox with the little bologna sandwich. Remember that? On the white bread with the perfect line of yellow mustard in there. That just looked so odor-free.
Now, your dad was not a cook, but he would throw these, like, extravagant parties that were all about the guests having, like, this great experience. Can you talk about what you remember about those parties?
Yeah. He wanted to be a painter, and he ended up as a theatrical set designer for trade shows, but also for theater. And he was pretty obsessed with the mise-en-scene of everything. So very attuned to how things looked and smelt and felt when you arrived. He was concerned with the lighting, and he threw these parties. He was a pretty generous guy, generous beyond his means, for sure. It was kind of, he didn't cook very much anyway, but when he did, it was impossible for him to cook for one or two. He had to cook for 100 or 200 instead. Never a part of an animal, always the whole thing. So we used to throw this party annually in the early summer, I guess, and in the back of our house, which was not exactly a normal house, it was a silk mill. We lived in the ruins of a silk mill, and behind there was this beautiful long meadow with a stream running through it. And the party he threw, we built a very large fire in a pit the night before, and all the kids slept out by the fire in our sleeping bags. And then in the morning, there would be this huge bed of coals over which we placed 3 or 4, maybe even 5 sometimes, spring lambs, and they just roasted slowly over that pit all day. And then, we had to mow the lawn and stock the stream with beer and wine, and we lit the candles out along the stream's banks, and then these 200 people came. It was idyllic, for sure.
You were the youngest of five. What did it mean to be the baby in your house?
It depends who you ask.
What did it mean to you? I'll ask you that.
I mean, I think my siblings consider me pampered and adored, and I'm sort of perplexed, but I'm like, what are you talking about? The whole family imploded before I even got a chance to grow up.
Yeah.
But I was indeed adored. I feel I knew very much, was very aware that my parents loved me. I sat in my mother's lap every night after dinner and listened to her talk to my father as the rest of the kids had been dismissed from the table. Being the youngest, I think I probably grew up faster than being the oldest because I was emulating these older brothers and sisters and wanted to run with the pack and be with them mm-hmm. so I could hang. So I was copying their behavior. And then in the particular case of my family, my parents split up when I was like 11, I guess turning 12. And so the childhood got abbreviated rather. Yeah, I mean, it was a great childhood. It just was abruptly brought to a shrieking halt.
It's such a moving chapter when you write about that because, like, you know, you're not the first person I've heard this from that, like, you had no idea there was a problem until suddenly there was a huge problem.
Yeah, I wasn't aware. I mean, I don't know if that's because I'm sort of internal and caught up in my own little fantasy mind and was just sort of living life the way it seemed. I mean, I didn't know to pay attention. And maybe they, it was not a, you know, my father was not home very much. I think mostly my relationship was with my mother. I mean, he was working all the time. He's quite a workaholic. Plus, he was trying to support a family of seven, so he had to be out making the money all the time. So what I'm saying is that it was not a household marked by, you know, arguing, bickering parents.
Right.
It was more a stressed-out mother trying to keep it together with the dad out making money. So I was not aware of any conflict between them until, yeah, we sort of were all sat down, and my mom was like, see ya.
And then your mom tells your dad, we're breaking up, and the kids and I have decided that you have to take off, which was not a conversation that you'd had with her.
Yeah, that was I would say, one of her most egregious mistakes of all time, to include us in her decision to ask my father to leave. I mean, I'm glad she left. I think, obviously, I think women are entitled to their happiness and to feel well in themselves and to get out of a marriage. I don't have any problem with that. But she did, in fact, include the children as if we, as a team, were against the dad. And I learned a lot about that in my own marriage, which is... no matter what, he and I are a team. We don't have to have a fine marriage, and we can dissolve our marriage, but we're not going to ever use each other or the kids in our own crap.
Yeah, it's really interesting here because at the time your parents split up, it's almost like they were done being parents, and they had your older brother who's a few years older, and you were still really a kid when all this happened, and you were kind of on your own.
Very much so. That's the end. That's when being on my own started. Yes, that's something else I've figured out, that parenting and marriage are two separate things, and you can, in fact, divorce and continue your parental obligation, one might think. So in the end, all is well, and I've learned a lot, and I'm fine.
Yeah,
it was
a
little bit, it felt like an emergency at the time to be in this house kind of alone with my older brother, and together, I mean, we didn't do this, declaredly, but we, just from our behavior, it was clear that we were not going to be allies or friends at this time. It was sort of, you go your way, and I'm going to go mine, and every man for himself, which is completely understandable. I mean, I was 12 or 13, and he was probably 15 or 16 or something, so we were acting as we... That seemed right for us, so I got a job right away.
Which is kind of an interesting story because you, you're not that old, but the labor laws were then what they are now, and you weren't supposed to be able to get a job.
Oh, really? Oh, I think...
Don't you have to be 16?
Well, right. I mean, you have to... I was lying about my age. I was 12 years old walking into this place saying, I'd like to be a waitress, please, because I was pretending to be a 16-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I had just started smoking and borrowing cars, if that's what you want to say.
Yeah, they were like at the repair place, right? And you would.
I used to go up to this garage up the street where people would bring their cars to get fixed. And at the time, a more benign time, I guess, you know, the keys were just left in the ignition or sometimes under the mat. And it was easy enough to just drive off with cars that, I don't know, maybe they needed some repair, but they worked for me. So anyway, I had learned to drive and I was smoking. And for me, it was kind of easy to pass myself off as a 16-year-old. So I went and got a job at a restaurant. I asked to be a waitress, which I had no experience whatsoever at, and the owner promptly trotted me back into the kitchen and let me scrape plates for the dishwasher. But as soon as I got in that kitchen, it was very clear how comfortable I felt, because we also, in the house I grew up in, well before it was popular 30 years ago, my mother had a 6-burner Garland and a 2-bin stainless steel sink, and when I walked into that restaurant's kitchen, I thought, oh, well, this is just like home. I know exactly what to do here. So that's how my life in kitchen started.
So after you graduated from high school, you moved to New York where you had a sister living. And your first job was in a restaurant bar setup?
Oh, the first job I finally landed was at the Lone Star Cafe. Do you know it?
Yeah, describe it for us. Yes, I've read the book, but give us a description.
There was a huge country western honky tonk.
In the urban cowboy days.
Yeah, exactly. At a time, I mean, that was the early 80s, and New York was off the hook with Wall Street making tons of money, tons and tons of money, and urban cowboy was kind of the trend of the time. So I was in the right place at the right time for a wayward, aspiring juvenile delinquent girl. So I got that job there and very quickly got caught up in a scam, and started, well, basically ripping the place off and taking a lot of money that didn't belong to me.
You and everybody else who worked there, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, there was a whole systematic scam. And I kind of caught on to it because I started to hang out with the older waitresses and do a lot of drugs and drink a lot of alcohol, and you got to pay for that. So we figured out a money story as well. And then, I guess a year later, I sort of caught the tail end of the high of that place. And as they started to do less business and have less revenue, the owners and managers started to catch on to something, and I got busted.
So you lost the job, you were arrested, right?
I got charged with grand larceny and possession of stolen property.
Mm-hmm.
And got arrested in a kind of unusual way, sort of over the phone by the officer. But when I did go into the station, we continued the interview, and I retained a lawyer, as they recommended. And the lawyer asked me how old I was at the end of our sort of strategy session. She was trying to figure out how she was going to get me out of this jam. And then she said, so just what's your date of birth? And she put the math together, and there was a pause and possibly a chuckle. I mean, I don't know if she started laughing or what. She's like, are you 17? She's like, let me get this straight. Have you been serving alcohol for the past year as an underaged laborer? So I got out of that one.
Gabrielle Hamilton is my guest. She's a chef and owner of Prune Restaurant in New York and author of the new memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think.
My guest this hour is Chef Gabrielle Hamilton. She owns the Prune Restaurant in New York and is the author of the new memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. Before we sort of move on from your time in New York at this point in your life, I want you to talk for just a minute. You describe how you started every day at this little Greek deli that I guess was around the corner from where you lived, and you would have an egg on a roll.
The greatest reason to move to New York City of all time. The famous egg on a roll. That we didn't have that where I grew up, so I was introduced to it at this it was called the Terminal Food Store, something like that. A terrible name.
Yeah, it sounds like a disease.
You think it might be your last meal if you eat there. But it was across from the Morgan General Mail facility on the near to the West Side Highway there. Yeah, that is a New York thing. You have a buttered roll, griddled, with a fried egg and some cheese and bacon, and the whole thing gets sandwiched between the two portions of bread, and that's breakfast. That's a New York breakfast.
And what's so perfect about it?
It's everything you want, but not separated on the plate. I mean, it's just like, I think normally sane people would sit down and eat their two eggs and their bacon and their toast. Leisurely, but you know, in New York, you got to go.
Yeah.
So you can just have it in your hand.
So you also traveled through Europe as a young woman, and you happened to go, you had very little money, and you happened to go like in the dead of winter.
I know, I'm such a dumb nut.
Right place, wrong time.
I didn't even think about the weather. I was so proud of myself that I don't know what I was, 20 years old, and I'd been really poring over the Atlas and fantasizing about where I would go and how exotic it would be. And when I finally scored this ticket, it was $100 all the way to Europe on a People Express, if you remember People Express. One way ticket to Brussels, and I landed in, I think, the coldest winter Europe had ever seen, or at least the coldest winter in 50 years, something impossible. And there I was kind of huddling in desolate, nearly empty youth hostels. It was not a very wholesome time to be backpacking through Europe.
It was like you and three drug addicts, right, living in the place where you were temporarily?
Everywhere I went, it was me and three drug addicts. Because, of course, who are you going to find in a youth hostel in January?
Yeah.
Not the, you know, sweet sorority girls from Wisconsin who are all there to see summertime Europe. That's not who you're encountering in January. So there's a lot of strung out, doped up people just hanging on. And, there I was with kind of dwindling little stack of American Express traveler's checks that I needed to keep me going for as long as I could. I ended up making it almost 2 years I kind of followed that backpacker's river where you pick oranges in Crete or you clean hotel rooms in France. So you do whatever you can. So I ended up working in a crêperie in Brittany. Mm-hmm. And I also helped open a restaurant in Turkey. And I lived in Greece on an island for a long time where I worked at a restaurant making Greek salads and washing the pots and pans and cleaning the octopus and the calamari every day. So I got a good inadvertent education. It was not exactly like the, you know, doing a stage that a young chef might do at a Michelin-starred restaurant in Europe, but it worked. I learned a lot.
You also, during this time, I think this is fascinating, during parts of this, experienced real hunger. Was that, do you think, also part of your sort of education about food?
I have come to consider my experience with hunger an important part of my education, almost as important as knife skills. Maybe not in my education, but at least my point of view toward food and toward having a restaurant, that I have starved. I have really been very hungry and without money many times in my life, not just on that backpacking trip, but when I moved to New York as a 16-year-old, I came with a jar of change, and I was living off of that for the first couple of months until I got a job. And trying to put meals together without very much money. And in Europe in particular, I spent so much time starving that I was fantasizing about what I wanted to eat or what I would get my hands on if I could just go back home and eat. And also there was food around me that I didn't have access to because I didn't have the currency or I was without money. So a lot of particular fantasizing about hunger, and I knew that when I finally came to open my restaurant, I knew that I didn't want to have food that was sort of esoteric or conceptual or
precious,
a substitute for entertainment. Mm-hmm. I just wanted food that would taste delicious when you were eating it.
You know,
that would satisfy your hunger.
I think it's so interesting because you write in here that when you were fantasizing about food, I think the assumption would be anything that is edible would sound good to you, but you would fantasize about very specific things that you wanted at that moment.
Yeah, somehow my hunger was never generic. It came on quite specifically, and maybe that's because the body starts to crave things, but I knew when I needed something salty or something watery and crunchy and clean or sugary. I just had very particular cravings. They were not vague by any stretch of the imagination.
So when you came back to the U.S., you were working in restaurants in a variety of positions. You did a lot of catering, which was like the, I don't know, like the MASH hospital version, I guess, of fine dining.
That's such a nice way of saying it. I mean, it was high-end, high-volume catering, which it's not inherently bad in and of itself, but when you cook at that kind of volume where you may have something like 5,000 or 6,000 meals going out of the kitchen to various locations at the same time, obviously something has to be done to that food that is not exactly, a la minute. We have to cook things in stages. Sometimes the meat has to get grilled off and marked a couple days in advance of the party. You're making dips and spreads in advance of the event. So it sits in a walk-in, and then it gets pulled out of the walk-in, and then 10 people have to touch it before it ever gets into the mouth of the guest. It's not ideal.
This was actually my job in college, so I really enjoyed this section because I related to almost all of it, with the exception of we never served shots of things. That, I guess, wasn't big yet when I was in school.
I think that came from restaurants, actually. I think in catering often emulates or has begun to copy what's happening in restaurants, I think because the people who can afford catering are accustomed to eating in very fine restaurants. And when the tasting menu came into existence, mm-hmm. and things had to happen on little tiny serving sizes that the shooter and the wonton soup spoon, the dumpling soup spoon, that got a lot of play in catering.
Talk about this. Your respite from this like factory-like catering environment came when, for several summers in a row, you cooked at a summer camp.
It was a very rural, I mean, I guess all summer camps are, but deep in the woods in western Massachusetts. And I was the summer camp cook for children who at the time I had no empathy for whatsoever. I thought, what am I going to do here with these little nasty beasts?
You just knew they drank a lot of milk.
Which I didn't even realize until I got there. I really stressed that job. Of all the work I had done previously, presumably much more, important and high stakes, cooking for ambassadors and kings and celebrities, I really stressed it out for the kids. I think that's when I must have understood that my heart is a little softer than I had hitherto thought. That I had a soft spot for the kids. But they eat like crap, those guys. They just want beige nuggets and plain buttered noodles. And so I did all of that for these summers. And the only difference is that I did it from scratch. We made our own chicken, our own beige chicken crap.
You have this charming story in there, though, of this one little girl named Emma who would ask for like balsamic vinegar. And do you have any fresh cracked pepper? Can you tell us about her?
I know. I mean, I still, 20 years later, have a crush on her. She's so sweet. I mean, she made my day. She would come up to the pass and had these very sophisticated tastes, which can be kind of obnoxious in a kid when they,
yeah,
you know, they ask for the balsamic vinegar and you just want to slap them. Like, come on, kid, ketchup. But she was not annoying in any way. She was just, she just wanted to make her food taste better. And I loved her. And we had Parents' Day, finally, in between the two sessions, and all the parents come up from New York City and see what their little darlings have been up to. And that is the day that I got to make a real grown-up spread with adult flavors and bread that could actually rip the roof off your mouth because it was so crusty and things like that. And so I put out a spread that was true to my heart. And this man with a kind of bemused smile came up to the pass and was just watching me struggle with this huge sea bass that I was trying to get onto a too small platter. And he said, "Hey, are you responsible for all this out here?" And I said, "Sure, I think so." Anyway, he said, "I'm Emma's dad. I'm Mark Bittman." So, right, this little girl had grown up with this New York Times columnist, obviously appreciating cracked black pepper.
Well, it's good that you could impress her, you know?
I mean, did you impress me?
So at this point, you're still thinking of, like, work with food as something that puts food on your table, but that's not what you want to do. And you go off ultimately to graduate school. Can you talk about how you decided to do that?
Sure. I was, at that point, I had spent many, many, many years in a kitchen already. I mean, if you count starting as a 12-year-old dishwasher, when I was 35, about to turn 35, I just thought, whoa. I've been here a long time, and I'm in danger of living a rather unintentional life, mm-hmm. and I don't think I want to end up in the grave having lived the wrong life by accident. And I had always, always wanted to be a writer, and that's not very conducive when you're working 18-hour days. You don't exactly want to come home and crack open the fresh notebook after an 18-hour day in a kitchen.
Yeah.
Really, what you want to crack open is a bottle of gin, frankly. But it was starting to seem long, and as I was about to have that birthday, I pulled the car off the road, so to speak, and sold all my stainless steel crap and got rid of my pants, my chef pants, and applied to graduate school, and I went to Michigan and got a degree, and. Really, I came back to New York and opened a restaurant probably 11 months later. Something about the academic life did not suit me. I finally understood. And when I opened the restaurant, I kind of finally said goodbye to that long self-image that I was going to be a writer. And I understood I was at a fork in the road, and I was going to take the left fork. And I said goodbye to whatever was down the right path. And, kind of grieved it heavily. I'm not saying it was an easy decision, but when I opened the restaurant, I did say out loud, forget it. Put that little fantasy to bed. You are a cook, and this is where you're going to cook. And then about, maybe 6 weeks later or a couple months later, I got my first writing job. I wrote an essay for Sliver magazine. I think that's very funny.
It's funny that in both cases you said, okay, I'm done with this, and then that actually
yielded. It comes back to get you.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a very nice story for me to say that you can come to the fork in the road and say goodbye to one, and it turns out that, in fact, they reconverge up ahead, or can. So for me, that's a very hopeful, optimistic way of going through life.
I want to talk about this, Gabrielle, because so many people who love to cook at home have these fantasies of how great it would be not simply to work in a kitchen, but to be the chef and to own the place. And it seems like you do a really good job, as much as you love your work, of disabusing people of the notion that this is like a fantasy dream life.
Right. I happen to think restaurant work is brilliant, and I love it more than anything. But what people should understand is that that's not because of cooking that it's so great. I mean, what we always say to young cooks coming in who who show up kind of breathless and starry-eyed, and I just love to cook, they say. And I always say, that's cool. Do you love to cook at 5 of midnight when a customer sits down? And we're going to be here till, you know, definitely 2:30 this morning. And when we're done cooking, we're going to haul out the mat. So you may love to cook, but do you love to cook for, you know, 11 hours straight late at night? What makes the job perfect for someone, I think kind of like all unions, you know, between people or between you and your career, is if you and it share the same crazinesses. So if your neuroses are compatible with the industry's neuroses, then it's a great job. But you shouldn't go into the restaurant business because you love cooking. It's so, that's not the point. You should go into it because you love to make order out of chaos, or because you love to hustle, you love to work, you like to be thorough. Yes, we cook, and yes, we take care of people, but I think you have to have that kind of prerequisite insanity.
You include in the book several, you're a list maker, and you have some really hilarious lists that you've put together, like all the things that have to get done in a day of your job.
Well, it does help sort it out, and it helps you manage time. I know they can be very funny, the lists, and they reveal how close to each other the beauty and the gruesomeness live. I mean, in the restaurant, in an average day in a restaurant, you're kind of swinging back and forth between, you know, gorgeousness and horror.
My guess.
On one hand, you have the beautiful produce coming in the back door that the farmer's dropping off. I mean, it is true. That does happen. I mean, I've been stung by bees when I check in a produce order sometimes. That's how alive and just coming from the farm it can be. But, you know, you turn around and the toilets are not functioning, or one of your cooks is having a grand mal epileptic seizure on the line, and that's not glamorous.
Gabrielle Hamilton is my guest. Her new book is Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. Join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Chef Gabrielle Hamilton. She owns Prune Restaurant in New York and is the author of the new memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. We'll go on the phones now to Mike in Garland. Hello, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I have a question about the genesis of the original, right? But I have to tell you before I start that question. Just as I picked up my phone to call you, it dinged me, and I got an email alert from Amazon saying best books for March. And at the top of the list was her book. It was kind of weird.
Cool.
I'm not making that up. It's just a very good coincidence. In any case, how did you go from a 12-year-old drifter to you know, somebody traveling to Europe to a cook, to writing a book, or to even get the idea that you should write a book, or could write a book? And also, could you talk about your undergrad education? I didn't hear that part.
Did I blank that out? Because it took me 3 or 4 tries to get out of college. I guess the question is, like, how did I even come to write this book after such a motley background? Or, I mean, in fact, I'm highly educated. So it was a roller coaster upbringing in a way, and wandering and many fits and starts. But I went to NYU. That's why I went to New York when I was 16. And I was supposed to start school in the fall, and I made it through, whatever. I stumbled through a semester and dropped out because I got caught up in drugs and couldn't quite make it to class in the morning after what I'd done the night before. So that failed. And then I got in that trouble with the law, and I had a friend involved at Hampshire College in Massachusetts, and I got everything, like an interview and an acceptance kind of in a phone call over a weekend. It was just insane. So I started at Hampshire and got very politicized there and also further confused, and I dropped out. I couldn't quite make it because it was pretty high level of, it was kind of like going to graduate school, but I was 17 or 18 and couldn't quite get in the program. So I dropped out, and that's when I traveled around the world. And after having backpacked my way halfway around the world and back, I kind of had this sense of, oh, I can do college now. I don't need the authority figure. I'm on my own, and I know what it means to finish something and get yourself from point A to point B. I had fully internalized that lesson. So I finally finished at Hampshire and then worked for a long time in catering and other odd restaurant jobs, and then I went to graduate school. And the book came about, how did it come about? I don't quite have a good answer for that. I have always wanted to write a book, and when I opened the restaurant, many people came right away and said, oh, are you going to do a cookbook? You should do a cookbook. And I didn't have that in me at the time. I didn't think the world needed, you know, another recipe for roast chicken. But somewhere along the line, I felt like the life was not being accurately represented. It tends to, you know, people really talk about the heat in the kitchen, and it's all hot and fast and terrible, and we're all a bunch of pirates, kind of. There was that kind of posture in some of the food writing at the time, and then, or very much the opposite, as if it was all, we cure our own lardo, and we wash our lettuces by hand, and we just let the food sing on the plate. You know,
we've talked to those chefs, too, on the show, yes.
I just feel like there are these two postures that don't quite tell you exactly how it is. And so I just thought, well, maybe I have something to add here. And I was very intimidated by that, I have to say. I grew up where books were absolutely revered. And, you know, I read the canon. It was not just, hey, you have a pen and a paper and everyone gets a book. So I was very intimidated to take it on. And then by fluke, I went to a bookstore. And I saw that there were thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of books, and I felt very relieved by that. I thought, well, if other people are doing it, then me too. I can add mine.
You know what
That's
I really
how it happened.
You know what I really love about this book, Gabrielle, is that first of all, it's not a secret. You're 45, and the book doesn't represent. It doesn't feel like you've learned your important lesson and now you're happily ever after. I sort of like the fact that you sort of leave us in real time because your life continues and you're not trying to necessarily draw a once and for all conclusion at the end of this.
Yeah, my motto in life is live and don't learn. Live and never learn.
Well, no, I don't mean it that way, but you know
no,
what I'm saying.
I know.
Was that an intentional choice or was it something, did your editor get it right away?
Well, I have the greatest editor because she was the gentlest hand of all time, and I didn't even use her in that way. By the time I was writing the book, I had come to it much as I do my chef work, which is I personally don't let a plate of food that's bad go out of the kitchen. I'm not waiting for the customer to send it back
mm-hmm.
or some other authority figure to say, you know, this is a little oversalted or this is burnt. I'm already making that decision before the food goes out. So I came to writing the same way. By the time I was writing the book, I understood that I know the difference between good and bad writing when I read it. And so the editor did not have to scold me or say, could you end this differently? She was a great second reader. And I didn't want to create some false, tidy package where, you know, now that I'm sitting in this Paris cafe having this perfect café au lait,
right.
My whole life falls into perfect perspective. That just seems trite and impossible.
And
not lifelike.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Brian in Dallas. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Gabrielle. I just wanted to tell you that I could not agree more with loving to cook is not a reason to work in a restaurant. Out of high school, I enrolled in a culinary school in New Orleans and Gaiden and decided to work in a restaurant over the summer. Quickly decided not to go to culinary school after that and got my degree in graphic design instead. So now I use my, I'm using my spare time now, though, to put together a cookbook of all of my favorite recipes that my mom has cooked my whole life. And then I'm taking them and updating all of her Cajun recipes and making them a little healthier. So my love to cook and my graphic design degree are now merging together.
Thanks for your call.
Love that.
What do you hear from people who, I would imagine there are people who say, I'm glad this wasn't my life, and there are still people who think, I wonder if what would have been different if I had tried this.
To open a restaurant?
Yeah.
I mean, I think if it's nagging at you, you should just do it.
Mm-hmm.
What's the worst thing that can happen, really, except it'll fail, and you'll be divorced and lonely. And estranged from your family because they'll have never seen you. But beyond that, just do it.
Let me ask you this. You do have two very young sons, and this is not an easy life to have when you're raising small kids.
No, it's I'm constantly asked about balance because I have these two kids. I started this book 5 years ago. So at the time, I was the chef and the owner of the restaurant, which is really two jobs. I had, my kids are now 4 and 6, but at the time, right, they were 1 and just being born. And then trying to write the book, yeah. I encourage people to get rid of the word balance in their thinking. And it helped me a lot because that was making me feel, basically I was chasing this grail that I could never, ever, ever achieve. And once I finally understood that my life will not ever be balanced, that it's going to rock and tilt like a boat on rough seas, then I got more comfortable. There are days when my children get all of me, and it's blissful. And there are days when they get robbed, you know, completely robbed. And same with the restaurant. There are days when I'm so on top of the restaurant, and I know exactly what's going on, and there are days where I'm not there, and I'm nervous. And, you know, not last, but you are not going to, you, the person, the mom, is going to also get the shaft all the time. So I just got accustomed to a kind of, binge and purge existence. Same thing with sleep. I really gave up on thinking about sleep in anything other than nap-like increments. And once I changed my mind away from being sleep-deprived toward nap-rich, that really helped out, too.
And there are also times when you, ironically, because you own and work in a restaurant, you haven't eaten all day, you haven't had a chance, and so you, this might surprise people, you sort of take Ovaltine as a supplement that gets you through the next shift.
I know, that is the joke of restaurant work, that water everywhere and not a drop to drink, like the shoemaker's children that don't have shoes. Yeah, it's true. I have loved book tour, which can seem grueling. I think I'm in 21 cities in 19 days or something.
Wow.
Kind of slamming like that. But I've eaten all my meals sitting down with utensils on this tour. It feels downright luxurious. I'm used to squatting down on the mats, eating out of a pint container, something that's vaguely cold, and doing so with my fingers. So that's how it goes at the the restaurant. You're not exactly sitting down luxuriating over a family meal.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with David in Grand Prairie. Hi, David.
Hi. I wanted to share a quick story of how unglamorous the restaurant business was. I moved to the city when I was 14, and I wanted to become an assistant cook. I was bussing tables and washing dishes, and I was helping the cook one day. The waitress had made him mad, and she had her arms full of platters of food, and he chose to scoop up a large scoop of flour, dump it on her head, and she was stuck there with the food in her hands. So we all kind of assisted her in removing that, and she went and got cleaned up and came back to work. But it was so unpredictable there in the kitchen.
Do you have a lot of front of the house, back of the house conflict at Prune?
That story. No, I mean that's one of the joys of owning your own place, that you can create the workplace you always wish you had when you were coming up. It's a pleasure to not have the barrier between front and back. And in our place, it's impossible. I mean, we're a 30-seat restaurant. The front is the back. I mean, just geographically speaking, in real estate. But also, I'm adamant about it. It's forbidden, and we don't encourage it. Every time a ticket comes into the kitchen, we say thank you to the server, and we try and mean it, even though it can be very frustrating when that ticket is coming in hard and fast, and maybe it hasn't been written properly or it has some special order on it. We still say thank you.
Can you describe the size of your kitchen at Prune?
Let's see. Could you describe the size of your bathroom? I think they might be similar.
Yeah, you're like inches away from everything that you might need to use.
Which sounds very ergonomic, and in some ways it is. You don't have to run from one station to another down a long back hallway. But sometimes I do get very frustrated and have restaurant envy for other people's places, not because I like the restaurants better, but because they have actual kitchens with one station designated for its purpose. So we are always doubling everything up. You know, the pastry station is also where the bus tub gets set for a few minutes. And, it's so frustrating. Because the servers have to pass in and out of the kitchen to get to the dish area, we say a lot of behind you, so all night long your work day is punctuated by behind you, and you have to kind of stop in the middle of what you're doing while the busser passes. And you could be trying to get into your reach-in to pull out your proteins or your salad ingredients, whatever you're trying to put together, and you have to halt. It's maybe that's why we are very family-like.
Was it any easier for you to tell your own story than other memoirists say that it is?
Well, something that helped me in writing the book was to approach it in the same way that I treat my day job. The way I understand my work, I'm in the service industry, and I'm here to take care of you and to make sure you have what you need. So obviously in the restaurant world, that means when you arrive, I have to make sure someone is there to greet you right away and make eye contact, and we make sure that the cocktail is cold and
By the way,
we've
got about 10 seconds. I'm sorry to rush you.
And then I tried to write the same way, that I want to make sure you have what you need to read this story and not feel lost or unattended to.
The new memoir by Chef Gabrielle Hamilton is called Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. Gabrielle, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh my gosh, thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.